And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
Summer is here in all its glory. Trees, flowers, bugs, and sun. And this summer, we've got something we haven't had in a long time. It's called hope. The message that nature matters has launched mainstream with the extraordinary success of Al Gore's An Inconvenient Truth. Come along as we capture the spirit when your voice of the earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Welcome. It's summer. It's here. I'm making the most of these long days by extending my adventures into the evenings with strolls on the beach, heading out in the warm evenings. It's always such a celebration of life. And I'm beginning to get increasingly more optimistic that we are beginning to see around the corner here, as it seems like even the media is beginning to get in line with what we've all known for years. Nature, life, the earth, this all matters. This past weekend, I went to see Al Gore's An Inconvenient Truth. Following all the gaga about it, and how there was a new Al Gore to reveal, I'd expected some kind of whirlwind of Gore stump speeches with energized throngs of supporters cheering and rallying. So much for the imagination. It was, in a more Gore-ish fashion, a scholarly multimedia event that basically said, you can raise whatever questions you want about global warming, but here's the facts as we can see them. My first reaction to An Inconvenient Truth is, just go see it. You don't need an excuse or a justification. Just go see it. It's not a wild scare tactic. It's not a political diatribe. It's a reasoned look at the issue. And while you're at it, bring anyone you can along with you, because people should see this movie. What's Gore's bottom line? Global warming is real. It has the potential to change forever life as we know it on planet Earth. We have 10 years to change direction, and we can do it. Next week, I'm going to take a deeper look at An Inconvenient Truth. This week, we're heading up to San Francisco to kick off this summer series with the Presidio School of Management. Ron Naser joins us for the second time as we look at their graduation ceremony and talk a bit about the challenges that his graduates face in the corporate world. In segment two, we fly back east and up into the skies with Southwings, a volunteer alliance of pilots who provide a priceless vision, literally, that is changing the way we see the world. And in our third segment, this past Monday, the Campaign for America's Future held their second annual conference. We bring you some specific remarks from Robert Redford, who we all know, and Leo Gerard, who we all need to know, about the future of our Earth. So that's all coming up when your voice of the Earth continues, following the news. So now, the news. The 2006 hurricane season is officially underway as Hurricane Alberto got ahead of steam approaching the west coast of Florida. Floridians, and just about everyone else, took Alberto seriously and boarded and evacuated, but alas, Alberto stumbled and turned into nothing more than a tropical storm, heading up the east coast. Predictions vary from normal to wild to furious for this year's hurricane season. We'll be covering it all, every step of the way. As global warming grabs center stage, global weirding is perhaps the best term for what is on its way. A recent report noted that one of the global weirdings noticed involved polar bears in the southern Beaufort Sea region of Alaska resorting to cannibalism. polar bears are known to kill one another in dominance disputes and as an instinctive population control behavior, but killing for food has remained taboo, that is, until recently. The polar bears generally rely on the polar ice sheet to hunt the ringed seal. But as polar ice disappears, the bears have fewer hunting opportunities, and scientists speculate that these new behaviors are the result. Unless these trends are turned around, many see the end of polar bears by the year 2100. Whether or not whales are just another source of meat and other products, or rather a sentient being unworthy of killing, is getting a renewed consideration, as Japan, which continues justifying whaling for purported research purposes, makes a powerful political move at the current International Whaling Commission being held on the Caribbean island of St. Kitts. The ban on whaling imposed by the IWC in 1986 is getting a serious challenge, led by Japan along with Norway and Iceland and other pro-whaling countries. Although the chances of the ban being overturned are small, requiring a 75% vote by the members, still, a majority vote, which is expected, could set the stage for changes in the future. Norway, which ignores the ban, is also considering forming their own independent regulatory body. The IWC has, amongst its members, landlocked nations such as Mongolia, which feeds speculation that their votes are being bought off with generous foreign aid programs from Japan. On a personal note to Norwegians, to whom I am related by birth, I say, for dat of a ligand. And speaking of undue influence to alter results, in Leipzig, where the World Soccer Tournament is raging, the Ukrainian World Cup players have complained that the nighttime chorusing of frogs in their accommodations nestled amongst the wonder of a nature preserve has been keeping them up at night and may have been partly the cause for their loss to Spain by 4-0 in the first rounds of the tournament. Some are saying that the frogs had been somehow induced to chorus by arch-rivals Saudi Arabia and Tunisia, who in their opening match tied 2-2, to which I can only say, ribbit. And that's the news. And a few special announcements. If you have a story that you want covered or have interesting photos or sounds from your personal domain, you're invited to share them with our listeners from around the world by sending the relevant information to wildsidenews@cox.net. That's WILDSIDENEWS@COX.net. And be sure to tell your friends about the Wild Side News. I want each of you to go out this week and invite one special friend that can double our listenership in a week. They'll be glad you did. All over the United States and various parts of the world, people are putting on their mortar boards and donning their gowns because it's graduation time. It's an exciting moment of grand expectations and visions and thinking about success. It's a time that really celebrates youth and their enthusiasm. And we in the nature and environmental sector actually have something to be very happy about, because we can celebrate a graduation that occurred this last weekend. And to really talk about that is Ron Naser, who is the provost at the Presidio School of Management up in San Francisco. Ron, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you very much, Sydney. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, for people who may not be familiar with the Presidio School of Management, give us a sense of what you guys are doing.
Well, basically, I will give you a short bit of history, is that Presidio School of Management is the core program of a school called Presidio World College, which was founded in 1993. And if anybody's been through the Presidio, there is a Thoreau Center, which is one of the really great spots for all kinds of environmental groups in the Bay Area. And Presidio World College was looking for a way to impact people who wanted to work in, start, or change their businesses to be sustainable enterprises. And as the years went on, after about 10 years of doing some certificate programs, they found a, if you will, market niche of people who were interested in really learning more about the business skills necessary to run a sustainable business. And the more they talked to people, it turned out to be an MBA. And so 3 years ago, we launched an MBA program, graduated our first class last year, and graduated our second class just this past Saturday. It's an MBA program, but we've chosen the words carefully. It's an MBA in sustainable management, which, as I know your listeners will know, means that it is not to just maximize return to shareholders, but is considering the social, human, natural, environmental capital that we all use and work with in running our organizations.
Ron, it almost brings tears to my eyes.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, it's really great. This is such an exciting time for us. It's been a long journey.
Yes, it has.
For us to get to the point where we have our own people who can go out there and bring to the world and the business world, which has such a significant impact, these concepts. It's exciting. You had your second graduation.
Yes.
This was this last Saturday.
Right.
And how many people graduated?
We had 21 students, and in the interest of full disclosure, one of them is still finishing up an incomplete. So that person will determine the merits of that case this Friday, but we had 21. We're very proud that of the 21, one of them was in the first cohort. People who are familiar with education know something called attrition rates.
Mm-hmm.
The first class that came into the program, there were 22 students. Last year we graduated 20 of them. One graduated last Saturday, and one is still wandering the halls, but will graduate one day.
That's fabulous. Well, you have your students aren't necessarily, and talking about sort of youth and what happens around graduation day, you have a unique student body.
Well, we do. Now, Sydney, I come from a long career in marketing, and usually one of the great characteristics of marketing is to segment and target the market. And we have, if you will, targeted diversity. And we, with a smile on our faces, say that the average age of our students is 35, ranging from 24 to 55. And so from the standpoint of age or demographics, it is a very diverse background. But in terms of them all realizing that business is perhaps arguably the most powerful force for change, for better or for worse in society, and all recognizing that it really is business leaders who will have an enormous impact sustainably, that they share all the students. We have a phrase which we call them realistic idealists. They believe in the larger social mission which every career should embody, but they want to be grounded to knowing a balance sheet, income statement, and cash flow statement, as well as other elements to run a business.
That's really exciting. I know that there's a lot of people out there who've gotten into business, and for one reason or another say, you know, I think there's another way that this could be done. And so they have experience under their belts. And, well, you really offer them an opportunity to do that life change thing that can really make a difference.
Yes, yes. Yeah, and I would say to that point, many of the students do come from, they've had enough experience to realize that this is, that their careers are not satisfying to them. And it generally comes down to not certainly needing more money, but realizing that there needs to be more meaning in their work. And what could be more meaningful than the regenerative tasks in front of us all to make the world more sustainable?
We're going to ask some questions about that in just a few moments, because I think that really gets down to the crux of what you're really trying to accomplish. You also had a distinguished commencement speaker who graced your event.
Yeah, well, we were very pleased. Robert F. Kennedy Jr., affectionately known to one and all as Bobby, gave the commencement address. He's been on our advisory board for several years, and was eager. As you know, the Kennedy legend is real in so many ways, and one of them is to inspire young people in the area of social service. What's been fascinating to him is that he has made great appeal, not just for the social or policy aspects of service, but of the business model. And it was very stirring for him, who was, he's a great environmentalist. River Keepers and Water Keepers and are the two of his organizations, to say that he is a free marketeer, and goes on to explain that eloquently, that what we have now is not free marketing, but it is really exploitive marketeering. And he believes that basically companies need to pay their fair costs rather than what he calls cheater capitalism. So it was a very stirring address. He then tied in, we have a basic focus here, Sydney, to help our students realize there, we use the word calling, but that there is something higher than just serving their own interests. And Bobby did a wonderful job of really talking about having your calling meet the world's great needs through the management of our resources, which he is so keenly interested in preserving.
I hope to hear that speech sometime. I think
it will be available. We are going to make it available. We're going to we're talking to him now about making it into a podcast and make it available, because he got, as he does often, and some of your listeners may have experienced it, he invariably gets a standing ovation, and did at the end of this speech as well.
This whole aspect of sustainability and business. And then, as you say, you know, it's large-scale enterprise. One of the interesting things that I'm thrilled about, and actually am and very much involved in, is this whole new sector. It's truly an enormous sector. And there, one of the exciting and or complicated aspects of that is the fact that there's a lot of money to be made in the sustainable future.
I mean, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, it's literally, people can start to think about their own realms of empire if they're really clever and they have a tremendous business savvy. There are literally billions of dollars to be made. And that raises a rather interesting question that I'd love to hear you give some thought to. And that is, you know, most of the people that would be listening to this show and people who are involved with the Presidio School of Management come into this, as you say, because they have a sense of calling. They perhaps have a kind of a humanitarian bent. They've been involved in the nonprofit world a lot, which seems to be associated with the type of work that leads to sustainability and concerns about the environment. And that's their nature. It's almost like they come to this with that nature. But, you know, there's a side to business that doesn't necessarily take you where you need to go when you get into the business world. There's some, just as an example, and then I'm anxious to have you give your thoughts. Many businesses, for example, part of their business model is to make sure that you do everything you can to diminish your competition.
Mm-hmm.
In many cases, it is to destroy your competition, perhaps by even just buying them up and putting them to sleep, or other forms. Which is a very aggressive type of business. It really is about almost doing damage as opposed to some sort of cooperative form. How do you start to address that with people, for example, in the Presidio?
Well, that's there's a whole model. You have touched on many of the discussions that come up in our school. I'll give you, and again for your listeners who follow these kinds of things, what you've essentially described as a name. And the name is called neoclassical economics, forgive me, but there is a name for it. And it means that there is a limited market, and that the only way to grow is take it away from somebody else. And there are models that have been built up on that. And there's another model, which is, it's got all kinds of different names, you know, ecological economics, but it's an emerging field where people say that it's not about beating the competition, but it's about which business has always been is serving genuine needs. Now, that's gotten turned inside and out, and I come from a long career of advertising, and I certainly know about manipulating people's desires in order to have them buy things they might not need. But basically, underneath it all, is that business marketing has always been, at base, serving the needs of others. And that's how societies organize themselves. We call them markets, and we have various names for them. We've invented money and distribution and other aspects, but basically, it's to serve the needs of others. And I'll give you a quote from one of our students. She said, after the program, our students always write a calling paper at the end, and she said, I have come to realize that an organized fashion of serving the genuine needs and wants of others is quite noble.
Well, that's a whole new concept for business.
It is, but basically, as a marketer, I'll tell you, that's what marketing is supposed to do. So we've distorted, to your point, Sydney, we've distorted various aspects, which are really almost like tactics, that predatory pricing, manipulative selling. I mean, there's a whole range of tactics that have been used that don't express the true essence of what the allocation of resources to serve the needs of others has really been intended to do.
Mm-hmm. It's a challenge out there, and unfortunately, and you know this as well as anybody, that when you get onto the business world, there are people who it's all about the bottom line, period.
That's right.
And I personally, if I was confronted, let's say I'm in a management role, and I'm confronted with that type of decision that I have to make, because a lot of these people are going to go into mainstream businesses to try to, you know, what's the secret? How do we try to help make that change?
Well, the basic one, and good companies have always known this, is that you if you want to get the best people, and now best is now meaning people who have these ideals. Before, best meant, you know, the sharpest numbers crunchers, but they're realizing that creative talent, if it's about new ideas, you do want people who are creative. And one of the things we've found with sustainability, and I'll give you, this will not be a technical term to your listeners, but it's an important, we use it technically in our curriculum, is systems thinking. Well, if you get people, and if you define creativity even loosely as the ability to make connections between two fairly disparate ideas, systems thinking is of enormous advantage if people are trained to think that way, to seek connections to then better serve the market. And what you go through always is that there are those people who will attempt to manipulate the numbers, and we certainly, I will tell you that it was a grand moment for many of us who are concerned about this area, when the guilty verdict came down on Enron, to really talk about what are we doing and what is a different way to model the business. And so what we're finding is that people are more receptive, not only just with this idea, as Bobby Kennedy said, he said, we're not doing this to save the spotted owls, we're doing this to preserve a way of life. And then the spotted owls and everything else form a piece of that. But the power of what he's been able to do, and what you're attempting to do, Sydney, and a number of others are, is to make that bridge between concern for the environment and how we go about organizing our society to serve the genuine needs of others.
That is what we need to do, and we're working at that. It's very interesting to start setting up these systems. That's what we're really working on. You have your system. I have mine. I'm very much concerned about public information.
That's right.
Education, marketing, you know. And we have to literally market these strategies. I like the idea of adding the concept of nobility.
Yes.
And quite honestly, from a marketing perspective, I really believe this in my soul, which is what I bring to my business. And that is that I truly believe the public is beginning to long for that in their choices. I really think they're becoming conscious of that. And so that's what's interesting about that is that becomes, for us to enhance that emotional content,
right,
which is very powerful,
yes,
in choices, yes. It really creates great new opportunities.
Well, it does. The thing I wanted to mention before, too, Sydney, and you're absolutely right, but we tell students about this as a field, we say, businesses like two things. One is that they like monopolies if they can do it. So then, you know, you're the only car maker in town, so they have to buy from you. The other thing business people like is change. Because when there's change, there's the ability to be creative and be able to sell products. And if you ever wanted the change that we know that this world is facing, is the, you know, pick your area, global warming, water, food, then you can, we always bring back this issue that what also will come up in one way or another. We talk about the environment, and I know your listeners are very interested in that, but the other area we put equal emphasis on is social justice and the ability to pay workers properly, the ability to, what is the gap between the CEO and the factory worker. We're finding out that one of the key things to run your business properly, you need to run it equitably. And we will find that when all is said and done, what we really hope is that we are attracting the finest, smartest young people we can find, and young I use in terms of not demographic, but in terms of mind and energy, to be able to do the work that needs to be done to create a more just world.
Well, it's a fascinating success story so far, and I'm I'm knowing that you guys are going to grow, as businesses must, and you are a business.
We are indeed.
And you're also on a mission and have a great vision. Ron, if people want to, and as people want to know more about the Presidio School of Management, help them out.
Well, the easiest way is Presidio, P-R-E-S-I-D-I-O, PresidioMBA, like the degree, .org. In terms of the people looking at the website, even those of your listeners who aren't interested in an MBA, and those, we find about half of the people who apply for the program had not even thought about an MBA because of their view of business. I'd encourage all of your listeners, every one of them in one way or another is managing something. I don't care if it's a household, it's young kids, it's a nonprofit, it's a club, it's a business. We're all managing something. We're all managing the resources and the gifts that we've been given. So please look at what we have on our website. Look at other websites to really strengthen your knowledge of business. And for any of your listeners who look on business as the cause of the problem, business is it's how we use the tool. And I would really encourage all of us just to become better managers of all the work that we do. Our logo is the Golden Gate Bridge with a tree, and we use that as our symbol. We really want to be a bridge to this idealism that we have to the real workings of the world, and we have one of the most beautiful human-designed structures in the world, the Golden Gate Bridge, next to God's nature.
Well, that is a wonderful bridge to a better future, which is what you guys are all about at the Presidio School of Management. Ron Naser, I want to thank you again for joining us on the Wild Side News here and adding your voice.
Thank you very much, Sydney.
Coming up, a dedicated alliance of private pilots are helping to identify and clarify some truly horrific disasters happening in people's backyards that are done out of sight, out of mind. Southwinds, next. Stay tuned.
I'm getting a catcher's mitt.
I'm getting ice skates.
I'm getting a jigsaw puzzle.
I'm getting dying coral reefs.
A blue bicycle.
A walkie-talkie.
I'm getting a severe drought.
Cool black skateboard.
I'm getting melted ice caps.
A killer heat wave.
A shrinking glacier.
I'm getting a devastating flood.
Adults are generous. We're even giving kids global warming. But it's not too late. We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. Go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
As the world's resource wars intensify, with increasing demands for raw materials coming from a developing world, those who profit from mining and harvesting from the bounty of the earth continue to use even more devastating strategies and ever more complex means of keeping it all out of sight and therefore out of mind. That strategy just got a lot more difficult. We find out why when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News. I'm a visual guy. I am fascinated with the earth. I paint the earth, and I'm fascinated by the beauty and wonder, which I think so many of us are. We're intrigued by our natural landscape. It provides us so much. But unfortunately, in many areas of the country, for various reasons, the landscape is under attack. In some cases, we kind of have to tolerate that because it's just called the price we pay for progress or something. But in some cases, it really starts to get a little bit out of hand. And in the case of what we're going to talk about right now, it's really getting way out of hand. And unfortunately, what happens is people don't have a chance to really see what's going on. It doesn't get in the media that often. And even those people who come out to visit some of the devastation get a limited perspective because they're literally on the ground. Well, sometimes to get a bigger perspective, a wider vision of what's really happening, you have to get off the ground. And there's an organization called South Wings that does precisely that. And joining us now to talk about that is South Wings Executive Director Taylor Barnhill. Taylor, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thanks, Sydney. Very glad to be with you.
South Wings. Tell us what South Wings does and what your mission is.
South Wings is a kind of conservation organization or environmental organization. We're a nonprofit, and our mission is to provide skilled pilots and aerial education to enhance conservation efforts all across the Southeast, hopefully to assure that the air is clean, our forests are healthy, the rivers and streams are clean, and that our communities are sustainable.
Now, how long have you been in existence?
About 8 years.
Discuss your membership, because you have a rather interesting group of folks who participate and help support your work.
We do. Now, and technically, we're not a membership organization, but we have a lot of other organizations and individuals who partner with us to support this aerial education and monitoring activity that we do. We're part of a large network across the Southeast of other conservation organizations primarily, including some university research organizations, and also a network of pilots who love to fly. Our pilots own their own aircraft, and they're always looking for a good reason to get up into the air. And they also love the earth and their own community. And so they have volunteered to fly for South Wings in partnership with other conservation organizations to monitor what's happening on the ground in places that are often behind locked gates or simply inaccessible from the ground.
There's another group, Lighthawk, that is doing a similar mission. Great people. And I have so much respect for what you guys do.
South Wings was actually founded by a former Lighthawk pilot. Hume Davenport lived out west. He was a Lighthawk pilot for several years and loved doing the work. But he was originally from Chattanooga, Tennessee, and wanted to move back home to Chattanooga. He did that and thought, well, why don't I ask around and see if there's a need for a Lighthawk type function in the Southeast. And people jumped on the idea, and that was the birth of South Wings.
I didn't know that. That's a great connection between Lighthawk and you folks and your work. Talk about some of the things that you've been doing in the last 8 years. What are some of the highlights, literally highlights, of your work?
I think the most active area of work is with the riverkeeper groups all around the Southeast, whether it's the Atchafalaya Basin Riverkeeper down in Louisiana or the Altamaha Riverkeeper in the coastal Georgia area or the French Broad Riverkeeper here in our area in western North Carolina. These tend to be the groups that benefit the most and have the most immediate benefit from aerial monitoring, largely because you'll be out in a fairly rural, remote area following a river corridor, and there may be an industry or some kind of other activity going on in that river corridor that is either illegal or not in the best interest of the ecology. And you can only gain access to these areas from the air. You could travel in a boat, but it could literally take days to get to some of these areas. So a 45-minute flight often provides the kind of information that might take many days by boat for these riverkeeper groups.
And obviously from the air, it's easier to spot these point sources of pollution and contaminants. Have you seen some of those yourself?
I have, and it's always a shock. Our mantra, as it's shown on our website at southwings.org, is "I had no idea," and that is the exclamation that comes out of almost every passenger's mouth as they come off the plane. They literally had no idea of what was going on to the landscape, because these are things that are out of sight and usually out of mind. And fortunately, most of our passengers carry cameras and can take some good aerial photos and get those back to the state regulators or to decision makers and begin turning things around. I've seen down in Georgia was probably the most striking perspective on river pollution. We were flying the Altamaha River, and in a very remote area, forested landscape as far as you could see in every direction, and there in the middle of the river was this huge plume of foam, this dark gray foam, and then a black plume of some kind of liquid, probably 60 feet across, flowing down the river. And we traced it back up to a local paper mill, and they had a large pipe, I don't know the size of it, probably 3 feet in diameter, that was underground, running through the forest, running under the water in the river, and came out in the middle of the river. And they just dumped their effluent there.
Thank goodness for you guys, because it became obvious.
Yeah.
Now, you're not really the activist group. You assist environmental organizations and others. In that particular case, whatever you can share, what then was the result of discovering that?
The Altamaha Riverkeeper, James Holland, was on the flight, and when he got back to his office, he got on the phone and began talking to the Georgia state regulatory agencies and let them know what was going on, emailed them copies of these aerial photos so that the evidence was undeniable. And in many cases like that, James is able to bring about a either a citation being written toward the company, or if it's sedimentation from a construction site, the state might go in there and order them to stop work. But in most cases, James is able to get things to stop, get the bad activity to stop right away. So it can be a very gratifying and very effective tool.
I can imagine at times when you're up in the air, you're seeing things that your mantra, I had no idea, you really weren't intentionally looking for something and have come across problems.
Exactly. I can remember a flight on the way to one part of the state to work with a Forest Watch organization, and we happened to fly over a highway's construction site, and there was a very significant plume of sediment washing from the construction site into a local lake. And as soon as we got on the ground, I called one of the local conservation organizations and let them know, and they were able to get a hold of the state DOT right away and get that stopped. At the same time, we're able to send an aerial photo so that there's no question that this is a significant activity that's going on.
Well, one of the one of your activities recently that I became aware of was your work in terms of working to unveil mountaintop removal mining, which is happening in primarily coal states. And the name itself is rather interesting, mountaintop removal mining. This takes the concept of strip mining and cubes it. I have to assume that a lot of people really aren't quite aware of the effect of this, because it's possibly carefully orchestrated not to be accessible, let's say, from roadways and things. Am I being at all accurate about that?
I think you are. When you're in the community below these mine sites, there'll be a narrow corridor up a typical Appalachian hollow, a creek valley, and you'll see the trees continuing up the side of the mountain, and then there will be this sharp edge where the trees simply stop. And if you're from there, you know that that mountainside used to continue up another 1,000 feet or so.
Hmm.
But because of the way the forests lie in these valleys, you cannot see from the ground the mining activity up above that tree line. And it is often very extensive. Some of these mine sites are thousands of acres. They're often the size of cities in their extent. And the only way to really see them, to get a sense of the scale, and to also understand the amount of destruction going on, is to be in a small aircraft above them.
When people go to southwings.org, they have access to some of these images, but I think some of the best images are actually available in a group that you're working with. Why don't you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. One of the best photo collections from these aerial flights is on the website of the Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition, or OVEC, and their website is ohvec.org. And if you go to their website, there's a button you can click on for their photo gallery. And it gives you an idea of the scope and the extent of some of these mine sites. Being out of sight, even local people often don't really know what's going on, but they know that their water has gone bad. They know that the air smells of sulfur and is full of dust and coal dust. And they know that there's this continuous sound of heavy equipment going on 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Mm. But even many local folks have been unaware of the extent of it, and they're often shocked when they do get into an aircraft and fly over it.
That is really shocking that local people in their communities, they've lived there, their families have lived there, in many cases going back many generations, are watching their natural landscape being destroyed out of sight, and they're paying the consequences. When you get up into the air, give me a sense of what you see, the extent of it, and how it makes you feel when you see what's going on.
Well, I live in a mountain region south of the coal fields in western North Carolina, and everybody who comes to this region loves these mountains. Anybody would love the mountains in say, West Virginia, for example. It's this beautiful, continuous, rolling landscape of native hardwood forests, southern Appalachian hardwood forests. These coal sites, you'll suddenly see in the distance this big bare area, and if people can imagine your favorite set of green rolling mountains and draw a line halfway down the side of that range of mountains and remove all of the mountains above that line and take the rock and the boulders and the gravel that used to be that mountain top and push that off into a valley and fill the valley with 1,000 feet deep fill of boulders and gravel that has no ability to create topsoil or nutrients. Any rainwater runs straight through. You're burying trout streams. You are creating basically a desert on the top of a flat plateau that goes on for miles, thousands of acres. They can barely get some exotic grasses to grow on it, but it is permanent deforestation. It will never support a forest again because there's no soil hydrology available. And the total loss of streams is about 2,000 miles at this point of lost streams because they've been covered.
That's extraordinary. How is it that they're able to do this? Do they own these lands? Have they leased these lands? I mean, you would think that the public would somehow have access to some of this, but what prevents that from happening?
Well, there's a lot of question about the mineral rights versus the property rights of landowners.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine you have a piece of property, and this property's been in your family for four generations. It came down from a great-grandfather. Say it's 200 acres of beautiful hardwood mountain land. And whatever that 200,000 or whatever that acreage might be worth, let's just for argument's sake say it's worth $200,000. And overnight, that the value of that land has gone to zero because of the mining activities around you. So your family inheritance is, which is in many cases your retirement, the retirement of all of your family, and many other heritage values for your family, is suddenly worth nothing. These people are often forced off of their land because of it's not worth anything, but also because of the bad air, which is causing serious health problems, and the list goes on and on. So you have a phenomenon of the coal companies being able to come in and take this land from people at a very low cost. We have an activist that we're working with right now who has fought all of his life to save his property, and he's just gotten a notice from the state telling him to vacate his land, that they're going to condemn it because it's unsafe. Well, the safety of it is a direct result of the mining that surrounds him, yet the state is willing to go in there and have him leave his own property that's been in his family for many generations. It's an incomprehensible situation for thousands of families all through the coal region.
As we look out into the future here, are there any breaks that can be applied to this? Otherwise, what we're looking at is, I mean, once this starts, it's going to be really hard to stop the expansion of these sites. What's the outlook for that region?
Well, there's a lot of laws on the book that would protect communities and families, but they're not being enforced. Some of the coal executives admit that they're breaking the law. They don't intend to follow the law, and they're going to continue doing business as usual. If there was something that might happen, if the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act were enforced, a lot of this activity would at least slow down. Unfortunately, 3 years ago, the Bush administration rewrote the rules within the Clean Water Act that redefined what fill material was, allowing the coal companies to cover these streams up indiscriminately. Before that happened, coal was selling at $22 a ton. The profit on a ton of coal was about 80 cents. Now coal is selling at $65 a ton, three times as much, and the profit is $20 per ton compared to 80 cents per ton. So the rewriting of those rules has been the incentive for the coal companies to pull out all the stops and to move ahead as fast as possible. I mentioned these green native hardwood forests. These are mature oak trees and other hardwood trees that cover thousands of acres, and the rush for getting the coal out of the earth is so fast that they don't even harvest the timber for lumber. They simply cut the trees, bulldoze them into the ravine and burn them. And just, you know, that just the waste in saw lumber alone is unfathomable.
Well, this to me is one of the worst nature environmental stories that I think exists in the United States right now. We have a real struggle going on here between forces of profit and people. This is not going to stop. When you have profits increasing from, as you say, it's a great, great statistic, 80 cents per ton to $20 per ton, that's a lot of profitability because these devices, these huge machines that come in there and scoop these things out, I don't know how many tons they're able to scoop out with every scoop, but it's a lot of money that they're able to make. What's your take on this?
It has to come from the citizens of this country. This is something that is fundamentally un-American, and I think people have to become aware of it. And when they are, the average American is not going to stand for it. These are their fellow Americans that have been here for many generations and have worked hard. Most of these people being impacted have worked as coal miners themselves back before machinery took over. And it's going to take the American people standing up and saying, this is not right. And one of the things that we at South Wings are able to do is to get those aerial images into publications like National Geographic and recently Vanity Fair magazine, Oprah's O magazine, the New York Times. Getting these images in front of thousands of people is beginning to shift the attention, and there's some changes that are just beginning to happen. But we have to stay on top of this and keep getting these images in front of the American people, and they will stop it.
When you say staying on top of it, that's exactly what you do with South Wings. You bring this to light. You bring it to the public's attention. You bring it forward. Nothing works like the images themselves, because the truth is the images are the truth, and we do need the truth. And you do it. South Wings does a terrific job. For people who want to learn everything they can about South Wings and become informed and help support your efforts, what's the best way for them to do so?
Our website address is southwings.org. If people would like to email me directly, it's taylor@southwings.org. I'd be happy to respond. And just continue looking at some of the other organizations like the Ohio Valley Environmental Coalition and their work. They're doing heroic work to stop these activities. I also encourage people to go see An Inconvenient Truth, the Al Gore film about global warming, and it helps us understand the role of coal in global warming.
Taylor Barnhill, Executive Director of South Wings, southwings.org, thank you so much for your extraordinary work. You're an excellent spokesperson. I commend you for everything you do.
You're very welcome, Sydney. Thank you very much.
We all have to do what we can to take back America. And this week, activists from many stripes came together to commit to doing just that. When I return, Robert Redford talks to you on what it's going to take when your Voice of the Earth returns here on the Wild Side News.
Melting polar ice was a dirty look. Shrinking glaciers, a nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us, hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. Then record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
For a long time, it has seemed that Americans are becoming alarmed at the ways in which our country is losing its way in the world and losing the battle to protect and preserve the great land legacy that defines us. The Campaign for America's Future convened this week, and you're about to hear two of the strongest advocates for planet Earth. It's Robert Redford and Leo Gerard when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News. There's a real struggle going on between an administration that seems determined to wrestle control of our lands away from the public and transfer such to the major corporations. It's really no secret at all that corporate influence runs the current policy. We witness such each day. Battles over whether or not rural communities in Wyoming or Utah will see their ways of life forever altered with massive oil and gas leases. The same is true with the issue of Anwar, a public land held sacred for posterity as a refuge of wildness. But the definition of posterity is suffering from a rampant short-sightedness. This week, an admittedly progressive alliance gathered as the Campaign for America's Future. On the opening day, the Apollo Alliance was given tribute as a strategy to once and for all forge a working sustainable path to self-sufficiency. There were many exceptional voices that stood up on behalf of our future, and today we bring you two who cut through a lot of the bull to tell it like it is. We begin with excerpts from Robert Redford, who addressed the crowd.
Ladies and gentlemen, let's give it up for Robert Redford.
Thank you. When you really understand this planet and its evolution and how it got here, it's just a miracle. So far, despite all the advances in science, there's been no indication that there's anything resembling Earth at all. And how we got here and how we stay here is nothing short of a miracle. And when you know that, you have to ask yourself, how can we not care for what we've got? I like to think that how about the planet we should have that's here right now? And what are we going to do about it when you have such a lack of leadership, which we hear a lot of talk about? There's an awful lot of talk about lack of leadership and at the top. Well, it's pretty clear why. We don't have that leadership. There's a stranglehold on both houses, probably Supreme Court to boot, and the bully pulpit. What are you going to do? Well, where's it going to come from? It can only come from one place, and that's from the bottom up. And in a way, I've always appreciated that may be, considering the compromises of the political system, that may be the best way. It's the American way to have grassroots coming up. For me, to give you a little bit of history on my account, I've been at this a pretty long time, and how I came to it was, I grew up in Los Angeles at a time when Los Angeles hadn't hit the high development phase, and I knew a city, even though I came from a lower working class family, we didn't have much. I knew a city that was pretty great in terms of the natural environment that was still available to it. You had the ocean on one side, you had the Sierras on the other, and so I took full advantage of that as a kid. And I think that's where I got my appreciation of nature and the environment. It was available to me, but once I got into it, I really appreciated it. And when things started to slide, when development went out of control and when no land use policies were put into action anywhere, you could see the consequences that there was a slight erosion, just chipping away at this beautiful, great asset. And then it went further and further until it was crawling all through the West, and now it's pervasive all through the country. So we talk about that aspect of it. I got involved. Prague, 1969, I became politically active in the environment. In 1973, I was at a conference in Vail, Colorado as a guest. And in that conference, they were talking about energy. And some guys, some experts were there, and they put up a chart. And it said, on the one side, this is a list of non-renewable energy sources. And all of our economic development, all of our industry, our lifestyle, everything seemed to be wrapped up in that category. And our energy use. I thought, wait a minute. And then over here was another chart that said these are renewable energy sources, and these are the alternatives for developing energy out of the renewable sources. And to me, it was like a no-brainer. And this was 1973. I thought, well, what are we doing here? This is crazy. Why are we not hearing more about this? Why are we not going in that direction? So I decided that I would take it on myself to investigate that category and do whatever I could, raise whatever voice I could to help anybody out there that was moving in that direction. So 30 years later, there was a lot of battles, and I got kicked around pretty good. And here we are. It's many, many years later. And only now are things beginning to come together in such a way where you've got a perfect storm of opportunity. The group of the group of leaders here today that are taking responsibility in their own hands in lieu of it coming from the top, from the people we pay to lead us and who are not. That's really why I'm here. And so I think you start by identifying, when you know there's solutions out there and that it's not going to come, it's a failed leadership in that regard, and probably many others too, but I mean, what are the solutions? And you say, well, first of all, forget Bush. Forget this administration. They're not going to change. You can't reason with a stone. And so... It's really pretty much a waste of our time to go up that hill without feeling like Sisyphus. So I said, forget it, and look to where the solutions are going to come. And what excites me, quite frankly, you've seen Al's film, there's a lot of doom and gloom in the message being put out there, because it has to be. We have to understand how bad it is. But there's also another side of the picture that I'm pretty well committing myself and my energies to, which is also an Al's film, which is where we can go that creates some optimism, and where we can go where we can get back in touch with thinking big again and dreaming again and thinking about hope again, which has been so savaged in the last few years politically. We can have it back again, and I think that it is a time for optimism, because it's a time for opportunity. And when you draw the picture, which is so painfully clear, that we're tied to non-renewable energy sources, that are tied to governments that are unstable, led by despots, it's pretty clear that we're in need of a solution. And what is it? Well, it's right here at home, and the idea of the new technologies that are available, which themselves will create new jobs, but the new technologies will create new products that will also create new jobs. And the best of it, as far as I'm concerned, is that those jobs are going to stay home. They're going to stay in our community. And we won't get into that sad issue of outsourcing and being dependent on other countries for our own sustainability. To me, that's very American, and that's to me much more American than the way we're behaving right now at the top. So the idea is now where, who, and what. And that's where you all come in. As far as I'm concerned, I've been here for a while. I've done what I can and will continue to do what I can. But the future is going to be yours and your children. They're my children. I already have my children. I have grandchildren. I got to think about them. It's your future in your hands to act on, and I know you're going to do it because you have the power. And you're going to be the catalyst to force political change from the leaders that are elected to lead us. And so I really am here to applaud you, and also the fact that Apollo has done something pretty amazing that is also very American, very grassroots, which is putting together a coalition of across-the-board entities that represent just about all of American industrial society. You've got religious leaders, you've got labor, you've got Leo, you've got labor, you've got military leaders, you've got environmental leaders, you've got farmers. I mean, you put them all together, and there you have the real American voice speaking. So to me, I find that very optimistic and just downright exciting. The other reason I'm here today support of the Apollo group, and knowing that that's going to be a handy solution that's right here, right now, is to present an award to a man who represents one segment of that group I just spoke about, and that's Leo Girard. And I'd like to say that Leo has been out there for a long, long time, doing something pretty terrific, and I'm happy to describe him to you. As a charter board member of the Apollo Alliance, he has worked to rally more than a dozen other labor union partners in the pursuit of Apollo's goal of creating good jobs through development of new technologies, policies and practices in pursuit of energy independence. As president of the United Steelworkers, He has reasserted his union's decades-old commitment to sustainable growth by winning passage of Securing Our Children's World as the official policy of his union. He is himself a man of boundless energy in pressing for the activism essential for building a more progressive society and a cleaner and more humane world. So in honor of his outstanding leadership in the fight for good jobs and clean energy, I'd like to present Leo Girard with the Apollo Alliance's first Right Stuff Award. Leo.
I want to thank Bob and Jerome and Larry for the kind words and this tremendous honor. Our union held its first conference on what was then called pollution abatement in the middle 60s. Our union led the fight to reduce coke oven emissions in the middle 60s. Our union led the fight to remove lead from the workplaces and fight for a lead standard in the 60s and 70s. We fought for a benzene standard. We joined with Dr. Silikoff to fight for the banning of asbestos and the elimination from our workplaces. With all due respect, we did this before we understood that it was going to be called an environmental fight. We called it an anti-pollution fight. We fought to remove acid rain in my hometown, which was the largest single polluter in North America. And we did that under the leadership of many presidents. But one of the most powerful moments in my time in leadership in our union came in 1990. In 1990, at an international convention held in Toronto, our then president, our future president, our legislative director, and our director of the occupational health and safety and environment of our union created a document called Our Children's World. And in that document in 1990, amongst many things that we said, a cornerstone of that document was that the issue of global warming was the defining issue of that decade and was the most serious environmental crisis facing the world today, and that our union was committed to doing something about it. On March 1st of this year, our International Executive Board unanimously endorsed a document called Securing Our Children's World, where we lay out the significant environmental challenges that face our society. We take on the challenges that few will be willing to take on. We make it clear that we're not in favor of drilling in Anwar, because the reality is there's less oil in Anwar than we would consume in a year. What the right wing wants is to be able to drill in Anwar so that they can prove they can drill any damn place they want, and we have to stop them. We have to make the case that we can have energy independence. We can have the case that we can reduce our dependence on foreign oil. We need to make the case that we need a diversified energy supply. We need to make the case that, quite frankly, if we just retrofitted our schools to current science, we could save more energy than we'd get out of Anwar. And our kids would breathe better air. Our trade with China has reached $200+ billion deficits. Our global trade deficit is excess of $700 billion. This year might hit $1 trillion. How many people know in the public that on a small, smog-filled day in L.A., upwards of 25% of the particulates have blown over from China, where they have no environmental standards, and we continue to sign rotten trade deals and send our jobs? We should export technology for renewable energy, not to export good industrial family-supporting jobs. Someone said to me, "Why did you join the Apollo Alliance?" I said, "We didn't just join, we helped found it.
And we did that because it's a natural extension of our fundamental belief. It's not a choice between good jobs and a clean environment. That's a false choice. We will either have both, or our kids and grandkids will have neither, and I want my kids and grandkids to have at least as good a shot in life as I had. I'm happy to also tell you that last week in Washington at the National Press Club, on behalf of the 850,000 members of the Steelworkers Union and the close to 800,000 members of Sierra Club, the Sierra Club and the United Steelworkers of America formally signed creating the Blue-Green Alliance. I'm not afraid to tell you, I'm going to catch some shit from some of our members. But I always remind them, shit's easier to throw than it is to catch. I can't completely leave my plant vernacular behind. But the reality is, in some segments of our newly merged union, the boss has been playing the card. Just like the boss does in organizing drives or in collective bargaining, when you want decent health care or decent pensions, they play the same card. If you want a good pension, we won't have as many jobs. If you want a clean environment, we can't have as many jobs. They're both a lie. They're both a lie. There's no reason why good jobs and a clean environment can't be available to all of us, as well as good pensions and good health care. This is the richest country on earth. There is no reason, economic or otherwise, why we can't have good jobs and a clean environment and sound policy for health care and pensions. The reality is that a country that's only had a democracy, only returned to democracy for a very few years, is on the verge of having energy independence. That country is Brazil, and I'm happy to tell you that the president of Brazil is a former metal worker union president who went to jail for the right to have a union. He's going to be, Lula da Silva is going to be the first president of a major democracy that leads his nation to independence, energy independence. And the question is simple in my mind. If Brazil can be the first country to have energy independence, why can't we be second? And why? What is stopping us? Let me close. There are those in the public who think we should sit back and accept the rhetoric of the rich and the powerful and the bosses that tell us you can't have a union, or you can't have health care, or you can't have pensions, or you can't have a clean environment. And I say to them, kiss Larry's ass.
To learn more about the Campaign for America's Future, visit ourfuture.org. Plenty of great ideas and voices and visions and hopes have been given to you on today's show. People are activating, they are uniting, and they are each doing the right thing. That is the mantra of the moment. Do the right thing. And continue doing the right thing until we meet again next Thursday or anytime on the archives. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet again when your voice of the earth returns here on the Wild Side News.